The Enterprise, Wednesday, August 10th, 2022. Raynham Park preps for sports betting. Legislation approval is a huge milestone. Raynham Park co-owner Chris Carney said state lawmakers' approval of sports betting legislation on August 1st means new life for the former dog track. "It's a rebirth to an old organization that we used to have in the area," he said. "My father, George Carney, started it in 1940, and he is still in gaming. He has been in gaming for the longest period in Massachusetts history." Raynham Park hosted greyhound dog racing for decades until voters outlawed the sport in November 2009. Carney said the lawmakers' approval of sports betting legislation is a major accomplishment and huge milestone for Raynham Park. Lawmakers approved a measure that allows people to place bets on professional sports teams. The measure also allows people to bet on college and university sports teams if they play in national tournaments like March Madness. People can place sports bets on a mobile phone or in a casino or retail location with a state betting license. A slot parlor, casino, and racetrack can obtain a sports betting license by paying a state $5 million application fee. Each casino is allowed to partner with two mobile betting platforms, and another seven mobile betting platform licenses will be available under the bill. Governor Charlie Baker previously indicated he would support legislation to allow sports betting, and he has until August 12th to approve the measure under state law. Carney said a new retail and simulcasting center would be constructed at Raynham Park for people to cast bets. "We are building a 65,000-square-foot building," he said. "It will be the largest retail facility in Massachusetts and only one of five retail facilities that have sports betting in the state." Carney said the foundation for the retail simulcasting center has been completed. "We are now waiting for the steel erectors to come," he said. Carney said his family gambled when they decided to have a simulcasting and retail center at Raynham Park before sports betting was approved. "Now the governor just has to sign the bill," he said. The new facility will also accommodate betting on greyhound, thoroughbred, and harness racing. Carney said the simulcasting and retail center should be completed in January 2023. "We are totally ecstatic," he said. Carney said the facility would have a couple of restaurants, two big major bars, and private function rooms. "We will try to hire back all previous employees along with employees' kids," he said. "We will try to make it a family business like before." Carney said he had received many phone calls from former workers and people who want to work at Raynham Park. "We have people calling us who want to sell us a security lock system along with heating and air conditioning," he said. "This facility will be the biggest thing that has come to this area in the last 20 years. Carney said he believes the revenues collected at Raynham Park when it's fully operative will exceed what lawmakers thought. He said construction of a 1 million-square-foot distribution center is also scheduled to get underway in January 2023 at Raynham Park. "We are waiting to get Massachusetts Environmental Permit Act permits for that," he said. Carney said leases of the distribution center by businesses would be managed by Portman Holdings, an Atlanta, Georgia-based development firm. Soupman removed as CEO amid embezzlement probe. Accused of misappropriating funds, Kelleher faces homelessness over what he calls a mistake. Peter Kelleher, known as the Soupman for his nationally recognized work feeding the homeless, has been accused of embezzling from the nonprofit he founded. The charity booted him as CEO and his landlords could evict him as soon as Wednesday. "I didn't steal any money," Kelleher said in an interview outside the mothballed warehouse full of clothes, backpacks, and other items waiting to be distributed to those in need. "I deposited one check. I put the wrong check in the wrong account." Kelleher started what became Support the Soup Man after his son Travis died of a drug overdose while homeless. In early March, the nonprofit's board learned he tried to cash a $1,000 donation check to support the soup man for himself, according to an internal investigation by former board member and attorney Benjamin J.W. Eddington. The board suspended him and imposed weekly drug tests. He tested positive for cocaine at the end of March. Kelleher went into rehab. In May, the board removed Kelleher as CEO of the organization he founded and whose name, image, and story have become inseparable from the group's widely lauded work, feeding, clothing, and providing mobile showers to people experiencing homelessness. He's been interviewed by Al Roker for the Today Show. In June, Bridgewater State University honored him with a Distinguished Service Award. Unable to pay rent, Kelleher faces eviction from his West Bridgewater apartment. A court hearing is scheduled for Wednesday morning. Eddington's investigation concluded that Kelleher doctored a $1,000 check from an East Taunton supporter, adding Peter Kelleher to the payee line, which originally read simply Soup Man. The allegations against Kelleher go beyond one check, which the bank refused to cash. Eddington concluded that Kelleher has habitually misappropriated STS funds since June 2021. Eddington documented $6,127.75 that Kelleher had taken from the charity, noting that he'd paid back $408.72 of that. Kelleher reimbursed the nonprofit a further $3,000, but the proceeds came from the sale of an industrial freezer. Kelleher's nephew, Christopher Sear, said the freezer was Support the Soup Man property. Kelleher maintains that the appliance was given directly to him. You can't pay stolen money back with stolen money, Sear said in a Friday phone call. To hear Kelleher tell it, Sear, chairman of the Support the Soup Man board, is the real villain of the story. It's Sear who took to Facebook and made the embezzlement allegations. He also made public that his uncle had relapsed. Sear says his uncle needs to get into a long-term rehab facility where he can be monitored. Everybody would look at it like I'm trying to bash Peter, said Sear, a Worcester general contractor and entrepreneur. I want what's best for Peter. He's my uncle. I love him. Eddington's report details evidence of Kelleher's continued drug use. While Peter has engaged in serious conduct that could easily be prosecuted, Peter is the voice of the people this organization serves, Eddington wrote. His ongoing struggle with addiction and recovery gives him the opportunity to be a positive example to those in the community facing similar struggles. The Massachusetts Attorney General's office has interviewed Kelleher and taken information from several people involved with the charity. The enterprise has learned. Kelleher said he came away from the discussion so far confident that even if he wasn't a good bookkeeper, that he's too small a fish. He, Sear, knows the Attorney General's office is not out for me because they have nothing, Kelleher said. The Attorney General's office had no comment. Sear said the office is trying to get bank records that Eddington did not have access to when he prepared his report. The two sides agree on one thing. It's a tragedy that the group's services to the homeless are on pause. You have about 423 very active volunteers looking to help. Valuable equipment, these amazing resources that could be put to use to help the homeless, said Nicole Tung, who handled marketing for Support the Soup Man until February. The number one priority is to get these resources to the homeless. Outside the nonprofit's warehouse in a West Bridgewater industrial park, buses and portable showers sit idle, with weeds growing under them. It's not clear when or if those resources will reach the needy. Sear shared messages he'd sent to previous Support the Soup Man employees whom he's asked to consider coming back to work. Some old employees say they'll come back and not be paid as long as Peter is not there, Sear said. We can't wait forever. We're either going to have to liquidate or donate to another nonprofit or get it running again. Kelleher's solution is for Sear to be removed from the board, a new board constituted, a new CEO hired, and that he could get back to work. I'd be back up and running, Kelleher said, gesturing to the warehouse. Those doors would be open. I'd have my volunteers in here. I would be the face, and I would be out on the streets where I need to be. Kelleher said he's getting addiction help via an outpatient program 3 times a week, though he admits not getting to support group meetings as often as he should. Kelleher supporters made a GoFundMe page aiming to raise $15,000 to keep him from becoming homeless. The effort had raised $10,281 before donations were put on hold after Sear made his allegations against Kelleher public on Facebook. The organizers said the money is in a bank account Kelleher does not manage and checks would be written from it to pay his rent and utilities. Man charged with impersonating officer and attempted rape. Boston police arrested a man they say posed as a police officer and attempted to kidnap and rape a woman over the weekend. Charles Singleton, 51, of Boston, claimed to be a police officer when he offered a ride to a woman he'd met at a social gathering during the early morning hours on Saturday, according to police. Instead, he drove the woman a short distance, pulled out a gun, and ordered her to walk out into a dark field where he groped her and threatened to kill her if she didn't comply with his instructions, police said. When the woman began to scream, Singleton assaulted her, took her purse and cell phone, and fled. Officers arriving say they located Singleton near his vehicle and recovered the woman's personal items as well as a gun equipped with a laser sight that had been discarded nearby. Singleton was arraigned Monday in Dorchester District Court on a range of charges, including assault with a dangerous weapon, larceny, kidnapping, and indecent assault and battery, according to the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office. Bail was set at $50,000, and he was also ordered to have no contact with the victim, prosecutors said. Singleton's lawyer declined to comment. Flu, back with a vengeance. After a two-year hiatus, the flu may be back this season, and with a vengeance. Data from the Southern Hemisphere, which is in its flu season, showcases surpassing pre-pandemic levels, prompting health experts to worry about what's in store for Americans this year. This might be an early warning system for us that this is the time now to start thinking about influenza, said Dr. Greg Sylvester, chief medical officer at Sequiris, a flu vaccine manufacturer headquartered in New Jersey. If we're not prepared, we could have a very naive population and we could see quite high rates. Health experts point to data in Australia, where flu season runs from May through September, to get a sense of what's possible for Americans. Like residents of the United States, Australians saw unprecedentedly low levels of flu during the pandemic. By mid-July last year, only about 400 cases were reported. There were no hospitalizations or deaths, according to the country's flu surveillance system. This year, by mid-July, nearly 205,000 cases have been reported and 181 people have died. There have been about 1,500 hospitalizations, with 6.7% admitted directly to the intensive care unit. Flu cases increased at a very high rate and ended up being at the highest rate that they've seen in I'm not sure how long, said Andy Petkoffs, a virologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. When cases went down, they stabilized at a higher baseline than what we saw pre-pandemic. Data from Australia's surveillance system show this year's flu cases have already outpaced 2019, when about 150,000 cases were reported by mid-July. FBI searches Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. The FBI's unprecedented search of former President Donald Trump's Florida residence ricocheted around government, politics, and a polarized country Tuesday, along with questions as to why the Justice Department, notably cautious under Attorney General Merrick Garland, decided to take such a drastic step. Answers weren't quickly forthcoming. Agents on Monday searched Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, which is also a private club, as part of a federal investigation into whether the former president took classified records from the White House to his Florida residence, people familiar with the matter said. It marked a dramatic escalation of law enforcement scrutiny of Trump, who faces an array of inquiries tied to his conduct in the waning days of his administration. From echoes of Watergate to the more immediate House probe of the January 6th Capitol insurrection, Washington, a city used to sleepy Augusts, reeled from one speculative or accusatory headline to the next. Was the Justice Department politicized? What prompted it to seek authorization to search the estate for classified documents now, months after it was revealed that Trump had taken boxes of materials with him when he left the White House after losing the 2020 election? Garland has not tipped his hand despite an outcry from some Democrats impatient over whether the department was even pursuing evidence that has surfaced in the January 6th probe and other investigations, and from Republicans who were swift to echo Trump's claim that he was the victim of political prosecution. All Garland has said publicly is that no one is above the law. FBI agents descended on Trump's shuttered-for-the-season home. He was in New York, 1,000 or so miles away, with search warrants. Monday's search intensified the months-long probe into how classified documents ended up in boxes of White House records located at Mar-a-Lago earlier this year. A separate grand jury is investigating efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, and it all adds to potential legal peril for Trump as he lays the groundwork for a potential repeat run for the White House. Familiar battle lines forged during a four-year presidency shadowed by investigations quickly took shape again. Trump and his allies sought to cast the search as a weaponization of the criminal justice system and a Democratic-driven effort to keep him from winning another term in 2024, though the Biden White House said it had no prior knowledge and current FBI Director Christopher Wray was appointed by Trump 5 years ago. Trump, disclosing the search in a lengthy statement late Monday, asserted that agents had opened a safe at his home, and he described their work as an unannounced raid that he likened to prosecutorial misconduct. Justice Department spokesperson Dina Iverson declined to comment on the search, including whether Garland had personally authorized it. About two dozen Trump supporters stood in protest at mid-morning Tuesday in the Florida summer heat and sporadic light rain on a bridge near the former president's residence. One held a sign reading, "Democrats are fascist," while others carried flags saying 2020 was rigged, Trump 2024, and Biden's name with an obscenity. Some cars honked in support as they passed. Trump's Vice President Mike Pence, a potential 2024 rival, tweeted on Tuesday, "Yesterday's action undermines public confidence in our system of justice, and Attorney General Garland must give a full accounting to the American people as to why this action was taken, and he must do so immediately." Senator Lindsey Graham said he spoke with Trump Tuesday and felt even more strongly after the search that Trump will run in 2024. "I believed he was going to run before," he said, "and I'm stronger in my belief now." Trump was planning to meet Tuesday at his Bedminster, New Jersey club with members of the Republican Study Committee, a group headed by Representative Jim Banks of Indiana that says it is committed to putting forth his priorities in Congress. The FBI reached out to the Secret Service shortly before serving a warrant, a third person familiar with the matter told the Associated Press. Secret Service agents contacted the Justice Department and were able to validate the warrant before facilitating access to the estate, the person said. The Justice Department has been investigating the potential mishandling of classified information since the National Archives and Records Administration said it had received from Mar-a-Lago 15 boxes of White House records, including documents containing classified information earlier this year. The National Archives said Trump should have turned over that material upon leaving office, and it asked the Justice Department to investigate. There are multiple federal laws governing the handling of classified records and sensitive government documents, including statutes that make it a crime to remove such material and retain it at an unauthorized location. Though a search warrant does not necessarily mean criminal charges are near or even expected, federal officials looking into obtaining one must first demonstrate to a judge that they have probable cause that a crime occurred. Two people familiar with the matter, speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss an ongoing investigation, said the search on Monday was related to the records probe. Agents were also looking to see if Trump had additional presidential records or any classified documents at the estate. Trump has previously maintained that presidential records were turned over in an ordinary and routine process. His son Eric said on Fox News on Monday night that he had spent the day with his father and that the search happened because the National Archives wanted to corroborate whether or not Donald Trump had any documents in his possession. Asked how the documents ended up at Mar-a-Lago, Eric Trump said the boxes were among items that got moved out of the White House during 6 hours on Inauguration Day as the Bidens prepared to move into the building. Biden signs $280 billion CHIPS Act in bid to boost U.S. over China. President Joe Biden on Tuesday signed a $280 billion bipartisan bill to boost domestic high-tech manufacturing, part of his administration's push to boost U.S. competitiveness over China. Flanked by scores of lawmakers, union officials, local politicians, and business leaders, Biden feted the legislation, a core part of his economic agenda that will incentivize investments in the American semiconductor industry, in an effort to ease U.S. reliance on overseas supply chains for critical cutting-edge goods. The future of the chip industry is going to be made in America, Biden said in a Rose Garden ceremony on Tuesday, referring to the diminutive devices that power everything from smartphones to computers to automobiles. The legislation sets aside $52 billion specifically to bolster the U.S. computer chip sector. The bill has been more than a year in the making, but finally cleared both chambers of Congress late last month with significant bipartisan margins. The Senate passed it 64-33, with 17 GOP senators supporting it, while the House quickly followed suit with a 243-187 vote that included 24 House Republicans in favor, even though party leaders began urging their ranks to vote against it after Democrats advanced a separate sweeping bill focused on climate and health care. The White House sought Tuesday to begin selling the immediate impacts of the semiconductor measure, noting that Micron, a leading U.S. chip manufacturer, will announce a $40 billion plan to boost domestic production of memory chips, while Qualcomm and GlobalFoundries will unveil a $4.2 billion expansion of an upstate New York chip plant. The administration has also repeatedly portrayed this legislation as a critical component in countering the influence of a rising China and ensure the U.S. can maintain a competitive edge against Beijing, particularly in semiconductor manufacturing. Administration officials have held multiple briefings for lawmakers to sketch out the national security implications of this bill, and Biden noted during his remarks Tuesday that the Chinese government had lobbied U.S. businesses against the legislation. The CHIPS and Science Act is going to inspire a whole new generation of Americans to answer that question, what next, Biden said Tuesday during the signing ceremony. Decades from now, people will look back at this week and all we passed and all we moved on, that we met the moment at this inflection point in history. Tuesday's ceremony is one of several public events Biden has scheduled since recovering from COVID-19, including a visit to flood-ravaged Kentucky on Monday and another signing event on Wednesday for legislation aiding veterans who have suffered from toxic burn pits. But Biden appeared to be dealing with some residual symptoms, coughing heavily several times during his remarks and apologizing at one point for doing so. Russian disinformation spreading in new ways. More channels pop up to replace blocked ones. After Russia invaded Ukraine in February, the European Union moved to block RT and Sputnik, two of the Kremlin's top channels for spreading propaganda and misinformation about the war. Nearly 6 months later, the number of sites pushing that same content has exploded as Russia found ways to evade the ban. Russian operatives have rebranded their work to disguise it. They've shifted some propaganda duties to diplomats, and they've cut and pasted much of the content on new websites, ones that until now had no obvious ties to Russia. NewsGuard, a New York-based firm that studies and tracks online misinformation, has now identified 250 websites actively spreading Russian disinformation about the war, with dozens of new ones added in recent months. Claims on these sites include allegations that Ukraine's army has staged some deadly Russian attacks to curry global support, that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is faking public appearances, or that Ukrainian refugees are committing crimes in Germany and Poland. Some of the sites pose as independent think tanks or news outlets. About half are English language, while others are in French, German, or Italian. Many were set up long before the war and were not obviously tied to the Russian government until they suddenly began parroting Kremlin talking points. They may be establishing sleeper sites, said NewsGuard co-CEO Gordon Krovitz. Sleeper sites are websites created for a disinformation campaign that lie largely dormant, slowly building an audience, and then through innocuous or unrelated posts, and then switching to propaganda or disinformation at an appointed time. While NewsGuard's analysis found that much of the disinformation about the war in Ukraine is coming from Russia, it did find instances of false claims with a pro-Ukrainian bent. They included claims about a hotshot fighter ace known as the Ghost of Kyiv that official later admitted was a myth. YouTube, TikTok, and Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, all pledged to remove RT and Sputnik from their platforms within the European Union. But researchers have found that in some cases, all Russia had to do to evade the ban was to post material from a different account. the Disinformation Situation Center, a Europe-based coalition of disinformation researchers, found that some RT video content was showing up on social media under a new brand name and logo. In the case of some video footage, the RT brand was simply removed from the video and reposted on a new YouTube channel not covered by the EU's ban. More aggressive content moderation of social media could make it harder for Russia to circumvent the ban, according to Felix Karte, a senior advisor at Reset, a UK-based nonprofit that has funded the Disinformation Situation Center's work and is critical of social media's role in democratic discourse. Rather than putting effective content moderation systems in place, they are playing whack-a-mole with the Kremlin's disinformation apparatus, Karte said. Tiny tugboat Toot Toot stands out in crowded Plymouth Harbor. With 20 years on the water, hand-built boat is a beloved staple. Among the towering charter boats, professional fishing boats, and even a 1600s-era replica of the Mayflower in Plymouth Harbor, chugs along a small toy-like vessel named Toot Toot that has captured the hearts of visitors and residents alike. The boat, a mini-tug, is marking its 20th summer on the water since then-Carver resident Mike Magnant built it by hand on his back deck. I took my wife to a boat show and said, let's buy a boat. Then I found out how much a boat costs, and I said to her, I think I can build a boat, Magnant said. It's 20 years old and still looks almost brand new. It was 1966 when Magnant had the idea to construct his own vessel. He first built a three-season room onto their home as an apology to his wife for commandeering their backyard. He reached out to Berkeley Engineering in California to buy the building plans for Toot Toot, which is the largest of three types of mini tugboats. That Christmas, his wife gave him a captain's wheel. I actually built the boat around the steering wheel, Magnant said. It took years to build Toot Toot on a budget. All of his materials were either donated to him, bought on sale, or found in dumpsters, including pieces of a tossed-out mahogany deck he salvaged. He finished construction in August 2002 and took it to West Island near Fairhaven for its inaugural launch. I put my wife in the boat, I pushed it off the trailer and said, does it leak? It didn't leak, the motor started, and off we went, he said. That was the beginning of my little boat, Toot Toot. The Magnants use their tug mostly as a pleasure boat, but do attend meetups and push-off contests in New Bedford and New York. Toot Toot, at 14 feet long and 7 feet wide, once pushed a 90-foot boat backwards down the Erie Canal, Magnant said. The boat is just wide enough to fit a queen-size air mattress, and the couple has spent nights under the stars in Plymouth waters. In honor of its 20th season, Magnant took the entire boat apart and refurbished it this spring. As a nod to those who say it looks like a toy amid the bigger boats in the harbor, he built a custom wind-up key that fits onto the stern. It's awesome. It's just amazing, Magnant, who now lives in Middleborough, said. Nobody can believe it has everything it does, but I've spent 20 years adding to it and making it perfect. It's cute as a button. People love the dang thing, and I just really enjoy it. A five-year teacher of precision machining at South Shore Regional Votech, Magnant said he's thrilled when people ask him about building their own tug and is happy to help anyone who asks. He's currently guiding a pair of builders in Australia looking to construct a similar vessel. He said tugs can cost anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 to build. If anybody is interested in building one, they are welcome to call me and I'll help them every step of the way, Magnant said. The satisfaction of making it yourself, taking your time and seeing how much people appreciate and love it, that's what makes it worth it to me. Anybody could do this.